Over to you, whoever wants to take over.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. I am so thrilled to be able to introduce my colleague at HERC, Dr. Laura Graham. Dr. Graham is an epidemiologist by training with almost two decades of experience in the VA. And her interests in research include improving access to and the clinical processes of surgery. So I'm so thrilled to host Dr. Graham today, and I will be taking questions for her at the end of her, what I'm sure is going to be a very interesting and enlightening talk. So Dr. Graham, please take it away.
Thank you so much. So today we're going to be talking about research design. The talk is going to start out with a couple of polls just so that we can kind of get a gauge on who's in the talk and how I can better adapt the presentation for the audience. And then we'll go through some of the overview of research design. And as Libby said, I am an epidemiologist by training. So this research design talk is really going to give you a nice foundation for the rest of the series this year. We're going to focus on epidemiological designs, cohort studies, case control studies, and then we're going to walk through some of the pros and cons of these designs. And this hopefully will give you that background that you need for the rest of the series, which really focuses in on some really cool methods and quasi-experimental designs. So I definitely encourage you to take a look at it because there's some fun ones this year. And then the last bit, I'll talk a little bit about measurement error and bias. And these are just components, things that you're thinking about when you're setting up a research design. So without any update, I was going to see, Rob, if we could switch over to the polls.
Yeah, that poll's open, the first poll. The question being, what is your background? Dr. Graham would like to know if you're clinical, from biostatistics, epidemiology, economics, data science, other mathematics or science background, or other non-mathematics or non-science background. So a lot of good options there. I see a bunch of people making their choices. I also see a bunch of no answers, and we don't like those. So come on, people, provide your answers. That's enough of the browbeating. We'll leave it open for a few more minutes, a few more seconds to give people enough time to make their choices. The answers are still flooding in, so I'm going to leave it open for a little bit longer, okay, Dr. Graham?
Works for me. It's nice to see everybody joining in.
You can see this, right?
Yeah, I can see it.
All right, it looks like things have slowed down, so I'm going to close the poll. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Close the poll and share out the results, and then I'll read them to you. And it looks like 33% of those who answered are clinical. 27% are clinical, 8% biostatistics, 6% epidemiology, 7% economics, 7% data science, 10% other math or science background, and 15% other non-math or non-science background. So clinical is by far the largest.
And then I think the next poll is just a really quick one, just to kind of see how long you've been in the VA, how long you've been working in research.
That poll is open. And this may take a little less time. We'll see. The answers are still coming in quickly, so I'll leave it open.
I always find this one really interesting to look at, especially with the cutoffs of 2, 5, and 10.
Right now, it looks like more than 10 years is the biggest. Oh, no, that's not true. 2 to 5 and more than 10. Excuse me for a second. All right, it looks like things have slowed down, so I'm going to go ahead and close this poll to Laura and show the results and then read them to you. 40% say less than 2 years, 22% say 2 to 5 years, 15% say 5 to 10, another 22% say greater than 10, and then there were some no answers. Okay, moving on. Back to you, I guess. Back to your slides.
Hey, thank you. Yay. So it's nice to see so many clinical here, and also to see some people from other backgrounds outside of math and science. So hopefully you'll find this presentation pretty easy. Like I said, this is going to be a nice little introduction foundation for the remaining presentations in the HERC series, which are really, really fun. I highly encourage you to check those out. So without any further delay, what exactly am I talking about when I mention research design? It is a framework or strategy that we use to conduct research. What I like to think about, or at least the closest thing, would be what would you put in your study methods if you're writing up a peer-reviewed publication? That's your research design. The reason that research design is so important and why we've got this first initial presentation on it is that it minimizes bias and errors while maximizing reliability. So if you put a lot of thought into it a priori, we have this thing in epidemiology that we call garbage in, garbage out. So really thinking about research design up front is going to help you to really minimize some of these bias and errors that I'm going to talk about at the end of the presentation. It also, replication is really important for good science. And having a clear research design that's well thought out helps you to provide a blueprint for replication. And it really also increases the credibility of whatever results you're getting out of there. So when we're talking about the goals of a good research design, this is a new slide that I've recently added, but I think most of you, if you've been in epidemiology, you've seen this figure on the right-hand side. The things that you're thinking about are trying to balance optimizing validity and reliability of results. We have a couple of different terms we use for these, but for now I'm talking about validity and reliability. Validity being how accurate a method measures what it's intended. So this would be how well you can hit the bullseyes. And reliability referring to the consistency or stability. So this is how frequently you hit the bullseye, how frequently you answer the question correctly. And so you can see kind of the balance across those two measures on the right-hand side with the upper left hand all over the place. So the answers that you get out of this research design vary drastically. So it's not reliable, nor is it valid. Whereas the one that we're going for is in the bottom right-hand side, where you're roughly about the same answer all the way through. So this is your goal for research design, is optimizing validity and reliability of your results. Now, there's a couple of guides online. I wanted to point you, before we even start talking about different types of research designs, point you towards these. My favorite place to go is the Equator Network. This is, as you can see, a link right here. It has toolkits, guidelines, all types of things for all different types of studies. As an example of what you'll find on there is there's the CHEERS guideline. As an epidemiologist, I tend to lean towards what's called the STROBE guidelines, if anybody's familiar with those. But basically what these do is break out the components that you need to consider for an adequate research design. So the example here being CHEERS, and you can see thinking about your target population, study perspective, time horizon, measurement of effectiveness. And of course, not all of these may be applicable to you, but going through this checklist can help you really optimize your research design. And really, when you start looking at these, research design kind of breaks out into three components: the study design, the data, and the analysis. So now breaking out all the different options that you have for research design, the first breakout that you're going to see is going to be quantitative versus qualitative research designs. And we're really going to focus on the quantitative research designs today. All of the talks that you're going to hear in this series are really based off of quantitative research designs, which is why I'm focusing on it. And qualitative research designs really are their very own beast. It's a very difficult type of design to do, and I am by no means an expert in qualitative research designs. So we're focusing on what I know right now, which is the quantitative research designs. And when you look at quantitative research designs, those break out into either observational research designs or experimental research designs. Most of what I'm going to talk about today is going to fall in the observational research designs. Just because I think there's a lot in this that bleeds over into why we do certain things in experimental designs. So the first breakdown here, quantitative versus qualitative. Like I just said, I'm by no means an expert in qualitative. I think that they are extremely helpful. Just side note, you can do mixed method studies with qualitative designs involved in them, and that can really increase the validity and reliability of your studies. The difference that you see between those two are going to be that the quantitative studies tend to be more formal and objective, the systematic process for obtaining information about the world around you. Whereas a qualitative research study, really, it's still systematic, but there can be some subjectivity to the approach that's used. And the goal is really describing more life experiences and giving them meaning. The goal of a quantitative research study or design is to test relationships. Or you'll see there are some descriptives, and also examine causal relations. Whereas with a qualitative research study, really you're looking more so to kind of discover these frameworks and gain insights. It's more exploratory. And so really that kind of boils down to the bottom row there, which is that quantitative, you tend to be testing a theory. With qualitative, really it's leading into this quantitative work. You're developing that theory. So under those quantitative research designs, like we talked about, we have that breakdown of experimental versus an observational study design. For experimental research, that is the gold standard. Most of us are familiar with randomized trials. Those are experimental designs. They are ideal for establishing cause and effect relationships, mainly because they're controlled settings and the investigator is manipulating the treatment or exposure variable. However, it's important to keep in mind that while these are the gold standards, and this is usually what we are trying to push for, they may not always be feasible for a number of reasons. Oops, sorry, skipped one. There we go. So here's kind of that side-to-side comparison, experimental versus observational. With the experimental, of course, gold standard, high internal validity due to control over confounding factors. You're randomizing exposures and treatments. Whereas with observational studies, you're not able to randomize an individual to treatment or exposure. So you do have a higher risk of bias. These are things like confounding variables. But often, because they tend to be more real-world data, they have greater external validity. One of the other things, like I've been mentioning, the experimental, you manipulate the exposure. Whereas the observational, you have no manipulation of the exposure. So you have to keep in mind that the subjects in your study are self-selecting into groups, which can, in some places, actually lead to some issues with bias, concerns about study reliability and validity. With the experimental, like I was mentioning prior, these are really only ethically permissible when adherence to the protocol does not conflict with the study subject's best interests, right? Whereas an observational study tend to be a bit more ethical. You're not intervening and you're not manipulating participants. And then the experimental side, these actually may be pretty impractical for some of the long-term effects or rare phenomenon. Whereas an observational study actually could be more suitable for studying long-term trends. We'll talk a little bit about how you can do that. Rare events or phenomenon that can't be ethically manipulated. And then the last little bit about thinking about observational, and this is the only time I'm going to talk about quasi-experimental designs. There are a couple of other presentations this year that will dive into different types of quasi-experimental designs. But the goal here is just like you can have mixed method studies between quantitative and qualitative, quasi-experimental designs try to replicate these experimental conditions in real-world settings. So you're using observational research designs, but applying these quasi-experimental methods to them. Some examples that you might hear are going to be time series designs, regression discontinuity, natural experiments, and instrumental variables. And I think that this year we do have some wonderful presenters that are going to be coming to talk about regression discontinuity and instrumental variables. So if you're more interested in those, definitely check those seminars out. The good thing about quasi-experimental design is that it actually allows for some causal inferences, which are typically, well, not possible for observational research designs if you ask an epidemiologist. But they have less certainty because you are not actually manipulating the data. So now, moving into the bulk of this presentation, for the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk about, well, really for the next like 10, 15 slides, we're going to talk about the different types of observational research designs. These are kind of the core components of epidemiology. And so I'm going to present them from that perspective. But I think that this will give you a lot of insight into some of the other designs we're going to talk about this year. So for observational research designs, just like we talked about with experimental designs, the investigator does not assign exposure status. They rely heavily on an understanding of how the subjects are selecting into treatment groups. This really is the source of a lot of the research design concerns for observational studies. They tend to be less valid than experimental designs, but on the positive, they're also less resource intensive. They tend to require less money to do, less time to do. They can also require less data at times to be able to do. And one of the other really cool things about an observational research design is that they are way better for rare outcomes. When you think about observational research designs, the first thing you should think about is analytic versus descriptive. Most of what we're familiar with is analytic designs, hypothesis testing, but there are descriptive and exploratory designs, things that you should keep in mind. So if you are designing your own study, or if you are thinking about options for, if you're actually doing a peer review and kind of assessing the validity of a study, keep these two things in mind. For an analytic versus a descriptive study, with analytic, a clear example is they are testing hypotheses. If you're testing hypotheses, this is an analytic study. They also tend to try to quantify the magnitude and direction of the associations that they're looking at. In comparison, a descriptive study really is more so just for generating hypotheses. So there's not hypothesis testing there. They're identifying, describing some of the patterns by place, time, or person in a population. And one key giveaway is that if you don't have a comparison group or you can't identify your comparison group, your study is probably a descriptive study. So the most common of all of the observational research designs that you tend to see is going to be a cohort study. Make sure that I get, yeah. So with the cohort studies, this is a well-defined group of subjects. And the key to a cohort study is that they are followed over time for an outcome of interest. The easiest way of identifying a cohort study is usually by how you're identifying your subjects. So if I am looking for all individuals who smoke, this is identifying by an exposure status, and that is a cohort study. Now, there's two different types of cohort studies, and this is usually where some of the confusion of is it a cohort study or is it not comes into play. Your kind of traditional way of thinking about a cohort study is going to be prospective, right? Because we're thinking over time. So a prospective study makes sense here. Your exposure is assessed before the disease develops. So an example in our case would be, is smoking associated with lung cancer? So a prospective study would identify people who are smokers and then potentially survey them or check back in with them at clinic visits to identify, have they developed lung cancer? That would be a prospective design. You don't know the outcome at the time that the exposure is assessed. Most of the studies we see this day, however, are retrospective designs. And so that would be that you would go at some point in time and identify an exposure status and then look forward in time to identify if an outcome has happened. The figure that you're going to see on the right-hand side there shows the outcome happening after, which can happen. You can have some mixed designs there. But most often, that outcome is actually going to happen. The researcher is looking back after the outcome has happened and after the exposure has happened. So difference here being prospective is you may not know the outcome, whereas retrospective, you do tend to know the outcome. Or, well, you will identify it. So some of the strengths of a cohort study, these are one of my favorite study designs. The key being is that it establishes a temporal association between exposure and disease. And what I mean by this is that it is able to identify that that exposure happened before the disease happen. And this is a weakness of a lot of the other designs that we're going to talk about here. One of the other strengths of a cohort study is the ability to measure incidence. So as I mentioned, with a cohort study, you're starting with the exposure and following over time. So there's a time component there. Having that time component means that you are actually able to measure incidence for cohort studies, which is something that you can't do with some of the other designs. Another really important thing to think about when your question might be better for a cohort study is that they are very good for measuring or for assessing rare exposures. And the reason being is that one of the key components of the cohort studies, you're identifying by exposure status. So one of my colleagues is looking at parahypothyroidism, which is relatively rare. And I'm realizing now is actually a disease. But if we were looking at that as an exposure for some other outcome, such as mortality or the need for surgery, that's pretty small. So if we were just taking a sample of the population, we'd probably get one or two patients with parahypothyroidism, which is not necessarily something we could use for an analysis. However, if we were doing a cohort study, we could identify all patients who were diagnosed with parahypothyroidism. We'll come up with our comparison or control group, and then we follow them for disease, which is why the cohort study is so much better for a rare exposure. One of the other benefits that you'll see of a cohort study is that it's very good for looking at multiple outcomes. So because you're identifying only by that exposure status, you're open-ended on what outcomes you're looking for. And so you can then look at other types of outcomes. You can also update your definition of outcome as well. And then, of course, the prospective studies, which I think are really good, but also can require a little more resources, allow for better control over sampling and better quality assessments. The reason being is that you are following these individuals with them over time. So you can update your definitions. Existing data may be incomplete, inaccurate, or measured in ways that are not ideal for answering research questions with retrospective study designs. Now, these sound really great, but they do have weaknesses. Keep in mind, these are still observational research designs. They're not experimental. One of the things to keep in mind that's a key weakness of a cohort study is recall bias. And this is specifically an issue for retrospective studies. So if you are asking for information at the time of exposure, but the exposure was 2 years ago, this can affect the information that you're going to get out of that individual. It can also affect the information that you get about your outcome as well, that the individual knows that they were exposed and also got the outcome. Another issue that you can run into with cohort studies is going to be loss of follow-up. So this is an issue for both prospective and retrospective studies. The longer the time, the more of an issue you can have for loss of follow-up. Prospective cohort studies also can be pretty resource intensive. So while they do tend to have a little more reliability than your retrospective cohort designs, you have to keep in mind that you're going to have to follow these individuals for a certain period of time, and you will likely need a large sample size as well and a longer follow-up period to take into account that loss to follow-up that you could experience. Now, one of the main weaknesses of cohort study, which is going to lead into our next study design, is that we are identifying cohort studies by their exposure status, but they're not good for rare diseases or rare outcomes. So if you identify everyone with parahypothyroidism, but you're looking at an outcome that only happens in 1% of those patients, then you're going to see very few of those outcomes happening on the right-hand side. So what's your next option here? Well, if you're looking for something that's more of a rare outcome, you could consider this case control study. So we're going to talk a little bit about this option for observational study designs. For the case control study, so research subjects are always identified by their disease status. One of the key things with a cohort study is that you do have the option for doing a prospective design, which comes with a lot of benefits and strengths there. The case control designs by design are always retrospective. So you're always identifying by disease status and then looking back, which can lead to some of the weaknesses that we're going to talk about in a minute. Now, they do also come with some key considerations. So because you're identifying individuals by the exposure status, you do need to be very careful about how you're defining your cases and controls. And so this is where it comes into this consideration of case selection. What we like to say in epidemiology is that your cases should be representative of all diseased subjects in the community, right? So that's first off. Controls, when you're thinking about control selection, the controls should be similar to all cases in all respects other than the disease in question. So they should be representative of all persons without disease in the population from which the cases are selected. And I think that is the key component there, is that this should be, the controls should have had the potential to become cases. So as you're thinking about your research studies and research designs, if you are considering a case control study, this section right here is very key to having a good case control study, is making sure that your cases and controls are representative. So some of the strengths and weaknesses of case control studies, like I mentioned, because you are identifying individuals by their disease or outcome status, a case control study is really good for rare outcomes. They're always retrospective, which means that they tend to be less resource intensive. Data is already existing. It takes less time. You're not following subjects. You're just doing analyses. And one of the flips from a cohort study is that with a case control study, because you're identifying by disease status, they actually are really good for assessing multiple exposures. So case control studies are useful for generating hypotheses about the causes of a rare disease or an outcome variable. Now, of course, they do come with their flip side of weaknesses here. Because the case control studies are always retrospective, they are definitely prone to more bias. So you do have to keep that in mind when you're setting up a case control design. And they also, you have no estimates of time typically in this. And so they do not estimate incidence or prevalence. You're identifying individuals by a disease status, and so you've already skewed your prevalence estimates there. And one of the other weaknesses to keep in mind is that they do examine only one outcome. You're identifying individuals by this outcome. So if you're interested in examining more than one outcome, either set up multiple case control studies or consider a different design. And that gets us into still analytic designs, but things that are kind of starting to breach are kind of move over into that more descriptive and exploratory areas. And the majority of the study designs that you're going to see in analytic hypothesis testing are going to be those cohort study and case control designs. But every now and then, you will see cross-sectional designs. Now, cross-sectional design does come with a lot of different weaknesses, but it can actually be pretty beneficial, especially when you're thinking about most surveys tend to be cross-sectional designs. So a cross-sectional design is when both the exposure and the outcome are assessed at the same point in time over a short period. So you think about the surveys that happen. That is, at the same point in time, you're answering, have you smoked and have you ever had lung cancer? Some of the strengths that you'll see of a cross-sectional design is that they tend to be really good at providing point-in-time prevalence estimates. So you know at that point in time that this survey was active, that 30% of people say they smoke, or 20% of people say they have smoked in the past year. So these are nice prevalence estimates. They also require less time to complete, and because you're assessing everything at that same point in time, they avoid a lot of the problems of loss to follow-up over time. There's no time between exposure to disease. These tend to be really useful. You'll see them, as you saw in the figure earlier, that they kind of lie in between this. They can be a hypothesis testing. They can also be exploratory. They tend to be really good to use at the beginning of a cohort or a clinical trial, really just to provide kind of baseline characteristics of the population that you're studying. Now, some of the weaknesses that you're going to run into, of course, you cannot estimate incidence from this. There's absolutely no time measure involved here. We just know that at some point somebody was smoking and they also developed disease. They also, branching off of that, provide less evidence of a causal relationship, mainly only because of that temporality that can't be confirmed. We can't know for sure that this individual was smoking before they developed lung cancer. And so that really breaks a lot of those causal assumptions and Hill's criteria that we are looking for when we're trying to determine causality. Now, another option that you might have, and this one right here is if you have, it's harder to get a hold of the data, or you want to look at ecological, which is groups studies. So the unit of analysis here is a group. Most often you're going to see things like counties, comparing counties, or it could be comparing VA facilities. These are groupings of individuals, and they result in aggregate measures that are reported. So these are descriptive, or you can actually compare these aggregate measures, which are result in an analytic or a hypothesis design. So ecologic studies are really good for rare diseases or studying this effect of like large scale public health interventions. So you'll see a lot of kind of branches into ecological studies within some of the topics that we talk about in the HERC seminar. One of the things that you need to keep in mind about an ecological study, though, is that you should always consider the potential for this ecologic fallacy. And what I mean by ecologic fallacy is this is when the relationship that you are observing at that group level does not accurately represent the relationship at the individual level. So this relationship that we're observing may differ based on how we've actually grouped these individuals. So these are key things to keep in mind if you're thinking about looking at aggregate measures by a group or ecological study designs. And then the last little bit in our nice little plot of observational study designs is the case series design. And so the case series design is really useful for if you have new disease processes or if you're identifying or describing these rare manifestations of disease. They're also really useful for identifying emerging health conditions. The example I have here is an older example of a case series of the first 1,000 patients with AIDS, which just the ecological study design, descriptive design, no comparisons, was able to identify 73% were homosexual, 24% were injection drug users. And it doesn't require a formal control group to understand that these groups of individuals were at high risk at that time for this disease. These were also really useful during COVID as well. So if you're dealing with something that's very new, very rare, emerging health conditions, possibly consider a case series design. They can be less resource intensive and can still provide adequate information given the question. The strength to these, of course, they're very cost effective. Like I said, these are pretty quick assessments that can happen. There's no control group. The weaknesses, however, because there's no control group, they are purely descriptive. And they are very much the weakest form of evidence. There's a lot of opportunities for different types of biases that may happen and things that you have to consider when you're putting these together. And that means that they can be misleading and oftentimes can suggest plausible relationships where really there's nothing in the real population. So just another option for study design, something to keep in your back pocket. But really the main types of designs that you're going to see are going to be those case control and cohort studies, with my preference, of course, I'm a little biased, as we'll get into a little bit more of the bias measures here, being for cohort study designs. So I'm going to, and this is not a poll, this is just something for you to think about. So I've got two slides here, and this is just kind of to orient to what we just talked about with the study designs. And I'd like you to think about what do you think this study design would be. So if I wanted to know if aspirin is associated with postoperative bleeding, so aspirin being my exposure, postoperative bleeding being my outcome. And so I decide, okay, I'm going to ask patients on the day of surgery if they took an aspirin that morning or the day before. And then later, like 2 days later, I'm going to go back and query the medical records and look and say, was there postoperative bleeding? So what kind of design this is? Well, or what kind of design is this? Well, the key element here is that second sentence. The first thing I'm assessing, how I'm identifying my population, is by their exposure status. And then I'm following them. So there's actually a period of time here. I don't know at the time of the assessment what outcome they're going to have. I query the medical records for that. So this, I would say, is actually a prospective study design. Very short follow-up, 2 days, but prospective cohort study design. Another example that you might see is for this one right here, which is, you know, I want to know, let's say aspirin again, this exposure. Does it reduce your risk of becoming infected with SARS, with COVID? So I send out a survey, and there's your key right there, the survey, that asks about daily aspirin use and if you've had a history of SARS. And so what I would say for this one is your survey, so you are assessing both your exposure, daily aspirin use, and your outcome of having SARS at the same point in time. So this is not a cohort study. It's not a case control study. This is very much a cross-sectional study. Some of the issues that you might have here is that you can't say that they've been taking aspirin, that it is actually associated with SARS based off of this. You can just say that those that have SARS also tend to be daily aspirin users. So maybe there's something to follow up with. So just a couple of examples of how you might actually use this to identify research designs. And then got two more slides here in the research design grouping. And these kind of look at, you know, you're not limited to just doing a cohort study or just doing a case control study. You can actually mix these to create more valid and reliable studies. So the hybrid study designs tend to combine different design elements. Some of the ones that you might have heard before are nested case control studies within a cohort study. You can also do these mixed method studies, which are bringing in a qualitative aspect to a quantitative design. These can be really helpful, and you should definitely consider them because they can be used to address some of these issues that we talked about that are weaknesses with some of these study designs and actually strengthen your overall study. So here's a couple of examples of some design concerns that you might have as you're putting together your study, and some hybrid study suggestions that might help strengthen your research design. So the first one being that your underlying hypothesis really is not very well supported. And if that's the case, then we know that qualitative designs are really good for developing and generating hypotheses. So you could add a qualitative design to support and guide the findings of the quantitative study. Maybe this might mean doing interviews or focus groups, or as one of our colleagues at the HERC has been doing, rapid qualitative assessments prior to starting your quantitative study. The second one on here being one of the limitations that we have for retrospective cohort data, it does not include detailed disease information. So if this is the case, then we know what study design is really good for outcomes and disease. Well, a case control study. So one of the options that you have is nesting a case control or another study design, which is a form of a case control study, a case cohort, to get more granular data that's not already collected. Of course, this would be on a subset of your population, right? It's only on those individuals that actually develop disease in your cohort. But if you can create a good enough case control design, those may be representative of the overall population that would have disease and could provide some really valid information. And then the last one here being concern about case and control selection, which is a big concern when you're thinking about case control studies. You want them to be representative. So nesting a case control design can also ensure that all cases and controls actually come from that same population, that same cohort. So these are just some ways that you might be able to combine some of these. So you're not limited to just doing a cohort study. You can identify, you can bring in qualitative aspects, you can bring in some of the case control, you can even bring in surveys and cross-sectional work to try and support and make your design a better study. Overall, your goal here is making sure that you have a valid and reliable study design. So with that said, I'm going to talk about some of the key pitfalls that you might run into. And this is measurement error and bias. And these can come from all different aspects, all of the study designs we've talked about. And we've kind of hit on some of these when we talk about the weaknesses of certain designs and the strengths of certain designs. So to dive a little deeper into what I'm talking about when I talk about bias and measurement error is error. It is the difference between what you are observing from your data and what the truth is. So the goal of a good research design really is to try and minimize this error. And you'll see here, there are two different types of error that you need to consider. So we've got random error, And then you've got systematic error. With random error, that is, and now you're starting to see some of the terms that we talked about a little earlier here, these concepts of reliability and precision, accuracy and validity. Random error falls into that category of affecting reliability, the precision of your result. So random error is the degree to which our research methods, or the research design that you've developed, produces consistent results. So think back to that bullseye measure. So you're looking for consistency of where you are hitting the bullseye. An example here would be blood pressure measurements. You can introduce random error when there's not a standardized protocol. So that means that, yeah, you're measuring things, just you're measuring blood pressure, it's just not consistently measured. And this is random. It exists in all research designs. So you're not going to ever completely remove random error. It is always there, but the goal is to try and minimize it. Now, another type of measurement error, and this is something that you can actually intervene upon, is systematic error. So this is the closeness of the measured value to the truth. So if you think about that bullseye, the truth being hitting the bullseye, your systematic error affects that. This is the validity of how, of if you are hitting the bullseye or not. It's the degree to which a method or a study actually measures what it is supposed to be measuring. So when we're talking about systematic error, bias, you'll hear that word and you've probably heard it. I know that we had a lot of clinicians on here who've probably heard it as well, is a systematic error in the design. The conduct or analysis of a study that results in a mistaken estimate of an exposure's effect on the risk of disease. Now, epidemiologists are, we really love studying bias. I'm really interested in it. You're going to see a lot of different types of bias, and we're going to talk about a couple of them that you need to keep in mind when you're setting up your research designs. The first being selection bias, information bias, and then also talking a little bit about confounding and endogeneity. For selection bias, so this has to deal with the method of participant selection that distorts the exposure outcome relationship from that present in they are from that present in the target population, or from that which is present in the target population. So some examples of selection bias that you might see, and you'll see down here, we have a lot of different ways of talking about selection bias. All of these are different types of selection bias. One that you may have heard of, non-response bias. So this would be if you're doing a survey and you are only surveying by phone. So that is systematically excluding patients without phones. This may cause some issues when you're thinking about the type of information you get out of your study design, and of course may affect your validity of the design. Another option that you have here to think about when you're thinking about selection bias, and this is particularly important for cohort study designs, is loss to follow-up bias. So this would be when patients without the exposure may be more likely to not complete the study. So if you are doing a prospective design and you've got a control group of patients who are unexposed, and for whatever reason, they are just not motivated to complete the study. So you need to think about those differences that can create a difference between your controls or your unexposed and your exposed in that cohort study design. Another one, which I see a lot, especially in healthcare designs, is confounding by indication. And this is a type of selection bias where healthier patients may be more likely to get a certain riskier treatment. So a lot of my research is done in surgery, and that risky treatment can oftentimes be surgery. So the healthier patients being maybe less likely, maybe more likely to get surgery, whereas patients who are not as healthy may not actually get the surgical procedure. And this can introduce some confounding by indication into our study design. And then the last one being volunteer bias. Patients affected by the disease may be more likely to participate. And this one you see a lot, especially with survey designs, that if you're asking about something that is particularly motivating for an individual, they've been affected by this disease or someone in their family has been affected, it's going to change, potentially change their responses on that survey. So do keep that in mind when you're thinking about cross-sectional designs. The other type of systematic error that we talked about is going to be information bias. bias. So information bias occurs when information is collected differently between two groups. This is misclassification. And it could potentially lead to an error in the conclusion of the association. So one place that you might see information bias, particularly in the VA, would be looking at a procedure that was provided by the VA versus paid for by the VA. You may get very different information on those procedures. One of the studies that I'm doing right now is looking at trying to identify unplanned procedures for what we call our access-sensitive care conditions. And identifying an unplanned procedure in non-VA is a different definition from identifying an unplanned procedure in VA. And so this may create some form of information bias. Now, you can have two different types of misclassification here. So differential misclassification, which occurs when the level of misclassification differs between the two groups. So that would be, in the example I just provided, if among the procedures that were paid for but not performed at the VA, we are way more likely to identify them as unplanned, and with the procedures that are happening in the VA, way less likely. This is differential. There's a difference by where that procedure happened that affects the definition of whether or not it was an unplanned procedure. Now, the better option here is non-differential misclassification. Still not good, but non-differential classification is when there's no difference between the groups, and this actually is going to create more random error than systematic error. So the other type of systematic bias to talk about here is going to be confounding. Confounding occurs, it's pretty broad, but occurs when the observed result between exposure and disease differs from the actual truth. So in contrast, and this is due to the effect of a third variable. Sometimes this gets confused with effect modification. In contrast, effect modification is when the effect of the exposure is different among subgroups. So it's not a distortion of the effect due to systematic error. It's just a difference among subgroups. And this is a demonstration of kind of what confounding looks like. So it's the association you can see at the bottom, the exposure leading to the outcome. The confounding variable is both associated with the exposure and also with the outcome and distributed unequally among the comparison groups. Also, one of the things to keep in mind with confounding is that it is not in the causal pathway from exposure to outcome. It just affects both of them. Now, you will hear throughout, especially, and this was something that we didn't talk a lot about in my epidemiology training, but the more that I work in health economics, you hear the term endogeneity. And so I think it's important to really have like a little side note here that the confounding and endogeneity are similar, but not the same. Endogeneity really occurs when a variable in a multiple regression model is correlated with the error term. So this may be due to confounding. It also may be due to residual confounding, omitted variables, are also measurement error in the collective variables, or simultaneity, which is when X causes Y, but Y also can cause X. So these are some of the reasons that you might see that the variable is correlated with the error term. Research design solutions that you can use to kind of address some of these things we've talked about. So one, restricting the cohort. Another one is instrumental variables, which there is a talk April 2nd about that for this seminar series. So if you're interested in those, definitely catch that one. You can also look at matching as a way of reducing confounding and endogeneity. And then, of course, statistical control. That would be a covariate adjustment or adjusted models. And then the last one being finding ways of randomizing subjects or using some sort of quasi-experimental design. And then this is the last little bit here. Of course, no discussion of research designs would be complete without talking about directed acyclic graphs. I try to encourage everyone to consider these when you are thinking about your research design. It is a visual representation of the causal assumptions of your research question. So it provides you with this conceptual framework to really unique to your research question and will really help you throughout your entire study, thinking about your question, your analyses, the data you're collecting. The key descriptives here being directed and acyclic. So with a directed graph, the factors are connected with arrows. So something leads to something. The arrows represent the direction of that causal relationship. And it's acyclic because no directed path forms a closed loop. So a factor does not cause itself. When we're thinking about these directed graphs, so here are some of the things that it can help to identify. Things like confounding, endogeneity during the study of design phase if you're putting this together. So, of course, you can identify things that may cause the exposure, but really have no association with anything else out there. And that's actually a really good opportunity for an instrumental variable. You may also identify certain types of comorbidities or characteristics that may affect both the exposure and the outcome. And that's identifying confounders that you really need to be considering and collecting. There's always the potential of unmeasured confounders that you have to keep in mind. And then, of course, even mediators can be identified with a directed acyclic graph. And with 10 minutes to go, that pretty much sums up everything that I was going to talk about when it comes to research design. I hope that it gave you a really good foundation for some of the remaining presentations for this year. And yeah, these are some of the references that I used in this. I know the slides will be provided to you later. And yeah, Libby, any questions? I haven't been checking, but I saw that you were answering, so.
Yes, so far there are two really great questions. The first one I actually was wondering myself. So the first is, can you speak to the strengths and weaknesses of nested case controls?
I think that nested case control studies definitely, and this is, of course, me, like my experience with this, I think that they can be extremely strong, especially if you really need additional information on your outcome. But one of the weaknesses that you have to keep in mind is that this is going to be additional work. And the issue that you run into with a nested case control study, that's not so much an issue if you just do a straight up case control study, is that you are limited to the cohort that you are pulling that case control study from. So if the cohort study that you are already doing your nested case control in is not exactly representative or has its own flaws, those end up being carried down into the case control design. So external validity could be affected, but it really does increase the internal validity of your study, I would say.
Thank you so much. And the next one is, selection bias is often confused with sampling bias. Can you please distinguish between the two? One example you give, surveying by phone, seems to be more consistent with sampling bias.
So I would argue that there's some overlap between those two, which is why they tend to get confused. And yes, you're completely right, is that the only sampling via a phone, I think, would be, yes, a form of sampling bias. But it also creates an issue with the subjects that you have in your study. So therefore, also still selection bias as well. I think the key, and this is something that, like, during training, we were taught to focus so much on the terminology that's being used. And I think the really important thing to keep in mind is that both of these really are going to result in the same issue, that the study subjects you have may not be representative of the general population that you're trying to pull from. And what you have to think about as a researcher when you're putting together this research design is it important for me to add other sampling methods to this? Do I think that that's going to introduce some sort of bias? Am I, by missing information from people who don't have access to a phone, am I in some way systematically affecting the estimate that I get that makes it less generalizable? So I think I completely agree with you. And I think this is actually a really important question to talk about, too, is that you will hear some slight deviations in terminology. The overall goal is to think about the impact that this has on your research design and the validity of your results. Does that make sense, Libby? Do you have any other like thoughts on?
No, I think that's a great explanation, and you've got several other questions. So with very little time on endogeneity, if it suggested a reverse causation, would a lag time analysis sufficiently address this?
That, you know, that is a really good question that I am not sure that I'm fully prepared to answer for that. I'd have to stop and think about that one. Reverse causation is such a big issue too. I usually try and avoid anything that's going to be a reverse causation in that situation. I would actually really try to go for a prospective design, just because the issue of reverse causation here is that you may have some temporal issue going on. And so knowing that if that's a really big concern of yours, being able to separate out outside of doing some kind of experimental design, but actually being able to separate out temporality and make that a strength of your study could help you kind of address some of it. Libby, do you have any thoughts about it?
Or? I was just going to say, you know, I'm briefly aware of some time series methods where you can put in lag variables that can help with this kind of question, but I am not an expert, but I would encourage the questioner to look into time series statistical methods and may find some answers to questions there. Next question is it fine to use all pretreatment covariates in covariate adjustment?
Oh, this is a loaded question. It used to be, that was how, like, starting out in what this is, or at least how I'm interpreting this, is when you're thinking about model building, how you're developing your covariate set for adjustments. And the traditional way used to be, it started out with, you'll hear terms like forwards, backwards selection. And then we leaned into this concept as data became more available and you didn't have to worry about the reason you're doing forward and backward selection is typically because you don't have the degrees of freedom to support including everything. And so then once we started to collect more and more data, it was like, okay, we'll just throw it all in. Like, if anything, it's just going to make wider confidence intervals. And that is also still frowned upon. There's been a lot of lean into, I think the more appropriate selective methods now are using things like lasso models, which help to minimize some of the variation. And then also, like, I would really, really encourage you to look at basing it more so on your directed acyclic graphs. So thinking really hard about what you think should be going into that model, as opposed to doing all pretreatment covariates and doing kind of like what I tend to refer to as a kitchen sink model. One of the other things I do actually like to do is I will actually build out staged models because there shouldn't be too much variation across all of these. It's not going to drastically affect, and if it does drastically affect your results, it actually gives you a lot of information about some of the covariates and some of the other issues you might have going on with the data. So yeah, really long answer to say I would avoid doing all pretreatment covariates in covariate adjustment. I would try and put a little bit more thought into why those are going in there, either using lasso selection or possibly doing something minimally sufficient subset or some sort. Libby, do you have any preferences? I know you do a lot of this too. So,
I encourage people to think about conceptual model, as you say, and sometimes using frameworks that are out there, that already exist. We have some in the health services area that are, very well known that, you know, sort of show the process of care, from a theoretical standpoint, and trying to use those standard models can be helpful to avoid a bunch of extraneous variables. And we're almost over, so I'm going to combine the next two. Can you please talk about detecting a potential mediator and how to identify confounders? And that's your last two questions.
So, mediators, there is actually there's a whole type of analysis called mediation analysis that I would highly recommend you look into. I am by no means can I speak to actually the steps of doing a mediation analysis, but there are very clear definitions out there for it. And I wish that that might be something we might want to talk about trying to include, or maybe I'll add in the upcoming presentations. And then just really quickly, as far as identifying confounders, so I think that prior literature, talking to experts in your field, those can help you identify it. Also, you can see them in your data. So if you do a bivariate association, yes, Brenda, we'll add mediation analysis. For the confounders, you can see those in bivariate usually. So you can see if there is an association between exposure and a covariate and between your outcome and a covariate. So that's another way of identifying confounders and seeing, at least hypothesizing that there is a confounding effect. But yeah.
And that's it, and we're at the top of the hours.
Nicely done.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you so much, thank you. Libby. Wow. You're wonderful. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Definitely let us know if you have any questions, and we're going to work on adding in that mediation analysis. Thank you, Rob.
Okay, thank you both. Attendees, when I close the webinar, a short survey will pop up. Please do provide answers to those questions. Bye, everybody.